Though not as tall as Mount Everest, K2, the Savage Mountain, is far more dangerous. Located on the border of China and Pakistan, K2 has some of the harshest climbing conditions in the world. 90 women have scaled Everest, but of the 6 women who reached the summit of K2, 3 lost their lives on the way back down the mountain, and 2 have since died on other climbs. In her book, Savage Summit, the true stories of the first 5 women who climbed K2, Jennifer Jordan brings the internal lives of these unique women to life. Jordan lived at the base of K2 twice while writing and producing the National Geographic documentary, The Women of K2. She spent the better part of the 1990s at WGBH-FM in Boston, where she anchored National Public Radio's All Things Considered. Jennifer Jordan, welcome to our show.
Thank you, Nathan. It's great to be here.
Well, it's very nice having you. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. It's the snow is incredible out here in Utah for any of your listeners that like true powder. I grew up on the ice slopes of New England, so this is like a whole new sport for me. So it's just great.
All right. Now, what prompted you to write this book? Was there a moment of inspiration? Was there a point in time, a catharsis, or was this something that's been building for a long time in you?
No, it hit me like a bolt of lightning. I was researching just the phenomenon of high-altitude climbers. As I said, I was from the East Coast. A high-altitude mountain to me was 10,000 feet. And I started into this story really when the disaster on Everest happened in 1996, and 8 people died in a single day. And that got me thinking about the risks and the rewards of high-altitude climbing. And as I researched more and more, one of the beauties, as you know, of being a journalist is you can feed your fascination and your nascent obsession with interviewing people. So I called as many of the survivors of that 96 disaster as I could find, and in the course of those interviews, started to realize that women high-altitude mountaineers have a different go of it. In some cases, have 2 mountains to climb, one, of course, being the mountain at their feet, and often another being the men at their back. And that never occurred to me, that women would have a different experience. And as I found that phenomenon and really started researching it, I found this little esoteric fact that only 5 women at that point had climbed K2, and each of them was dead. And I, as a reporter, I had a sea change. And I had to, don't know why, I don't know what it is about those stories that so hooked my soul and my mind, but it did. And I had to find out. And I'm now, 7 years later, trying to really come to grips with who they were, how they lived, and how they all died.
Can you tell us a little bit about K2, what makes it unique?
K2, as you said, Nathan, sits on the Chinese-Pakistan border, and it's 900 miles north and west of Everest at the end of the Himalayan chain. And I think that's one of the first reasons it's so distinct and different from Everest, is it's so remote. And getting there takes a week to 10 days today. Back in the old days, it took up to a month on foot. And now it's just, it's so remote and so out there that it didn't even have a local name the way Everest does by the tribes living at its base. Another thing, because of the 900 miles north and west of Everest, it is a lot colder mountain. It's like Denali compared to, the mountains down here in the continental U.S. Mm-hmm. And the winters, or I shouldn't say the winters, the climbing season is a lot colder and a lot harsher, even though it's longer than Everest because it doesn't have a monsoon season. The storms are much more severe. They come in without warning, and they stay longer, and you don't have the climbing window that you do. If you get a 3-day climbing window on K2, you're lucky. And the third reason that really separates it from Everest and the other 8,000-meter peaks is the fact that K2 doesn't have the infrastructure. It doesn't have the support of climbing Sherpas, number one, and climbing Sherpas who are taking your bottled oxygen high on the mountain, number two. So all of these factors make K2 a lot more difficult to climb and a lot more deadly.
And Jennifer, does some of that account for, in your research, why so few women have climbed K2, or are there other additional factors?
Well, Joy, women represent only 5% of the Himalayan climbing population anyway. K2, Everest, Choyo U, Shishapang, I mean, you name the mountain, only 5% of the people approaching it, by and large, are women. So it's really, you know, K2 has lower numbers anyway because it is so remote and hard to get to, and because Everest has the cachet of being number one. Mm-hmm. So women aren't necessarily staying away from K2 more than they are Everest. It's just all the numbers are down for men and women.
But there's survival rates coming off K2, as you said, that you were so startled by at first.
Yes.
Talk about that.
Actually, we should really call it the death rate.
Death rate, right.
Survival rate. And the death rate is staggering. When you look at overall numbers of, you know, women who've made the summit and women who've died in the process, You have 6 women who've made the summit, because a 6th woman made it in the summer of 2004, mm-hmm. and 5 women dying in the process. So you've just got this really horrifyingly, in my opinion, large ratio of attempts to deaths on the mountain and summits to deaths on the mountain. And the reasons for those are varied. A lot of it has to do with freak weather that nobody can control. Some of it has to do with sheer physical strength and how after a week to 10 days at altitude without bottled oxygen, I don't care who you are, you're becoming shriveled down to nothing.
You're beginning to die.
You're absolutely beginning to die. And I think when trouble does hit high on the mountain, sometimes men, because they are physically larger and they have a larger musculature, just have that much more reserve to survive a life and death situation. And number 3, unfortunately, in my research and in my opinion, it has come down, the women's high death rate on K2 has come down to lack of experience. In a couple of the cases, they were out of their element, and when trouble hit, they physically and emotionally didn't react well, and it was their demise.
Can you tell us something about those experiences that they had? What was the tragedy? What tipped it for them?
Well, this is another thing about these deaths, is that each of the 5 deaths of the women of K2 is a mystery, because either they died with their climbing partner, so there's mm-hmm. no witness, or, and I guess that's the end of the sentence, there is no living witness to the deaths of any of these women. Hmm. And so for me, it's like, wait a minute. You know, how do I do this research? You're putting me out there on an even tougher limb. And so each of their stories is a tragedy, in my opinion, and it's also a mystery. So trying to unravel how and why they died for any mountain climber is almost impossible, and particularly for those that don't have a witness to it. But as far as what I've been able to unravel in those deaths, in some cases the women, and, you know, again, as I start telling the stories, I was thinking of Allison Hargreaves, who was climbing with 6 other men, and they made the summit and then turned for descent, and freak winds came out of China and blew each of them off the mountain. So can you, you know, that's really not a male-female thing, because she died with a group of men. That said, Peter Hillary, who was on the climb with her, the son of Sir Edmund, who was on the climb with her early in the day, turned back because he didn't like the look of the incoming winds and weather. Now other people, you know, with her decided to keep going. So, you know, that's a tough one to call. They're all tough to call. But they each died very dramatically, very violently, and very tragically.
Now, you were at the base of K2 for how long were you at the base of K2, and what was that like?
Each time I was there between 2 to 2.5 months at the base. I mean, the trips themselves were between 3 and 4 months because, as I said, getting in and getting out is that difficult. And it was devastating, mostly because I was there with my then partner, now husband, and I, especially the second time I went, I knew too much, and I had done my research, and I knew that I was standing in a place where each of these women had climbed and 3 of them remained, that 3 of them had died. Mm-hmm. And there I was watching my partner head up into this death zone, this death arena, really. And it was very difficult emotionally to watch him go and to remain in base camp and do my notes and read my research and do what I had to do to kind of remain sane. And another thing, Nathan, that made it really difficult was that I would walk the glacier in the afternoons. I'd spend the mornings writing, and I would walk the glacier in the afternoon for exercise. And I would come upon the remains and the refuse of old expeditions.
Yeah.
And some of it was very benign. Some of it was old hats and mittens and parkas and tent fabrics. And some of it was body parts and whole bodies in some cases. And I would be left, because I was virtually alone, to bury those remains. And that was just, day after day, kind of crawling back into the tent and sobbing myself to sleep. It was very difficult. And it still remains difficult, because those kinds of images don't leave your mind's eye just because your mind leaves the physical place.
Mm-hmm. Well, Nathan and I were discussing before we got you on the air what makes this possibly a more male-dominated sport. It obviously is, but... in this story you just told, your male partner is up on the mountain and you're behind, you're not climbing it. Were you ever compelled to climb it yourself? And what do you think was going through some of the minds of these women?
Well, I think the easiest way to get at that is to answer why I think more women don't enter the sport. And I think that it comes down to the fact that women are not very good at compartmentalizing, and men tend to be. I interviewed Rick Ridgway, who was one of the first Americans to climb K2 in 1978, and I asked him this question, because their teams, both their teams in 75 and 78, were nearly torn apart because of the presence of a woman. And so I was asking him about women in the sport and women on the mountain and women in K2 in particular. And so I said, it occurs to me as a woman who's been there twice that perhaps what we're looking at is the fact that when women go off for months at a time, largely out of communication, the anxieties of home, the troubled teen perhaps, the elderly parent, the sick dog, I mean, you name it, the house mortgage payments, those kinds of concerns don't leave the woman's brain. And perhaps for you guys, I said, looking at Rick, they do. And he looked at me like I had given him the Holy Grail, and he said, it never occurred to me. But he said, I was able to get on that plane with a wife, with children, with a home, with a job, and not think of them again. That's too harsh.
But somehow leave it where it...
Absolutely. That was a box that he would occasionally open when he was able to at base camp in the off moments and look at and think at and write letters and shut it back down and go back on the mountain. So, now getting to your other question about how women have dealt with that at the mountain, we know that Alison Hargreaves, who left two toddlers behind in Scotland, would get faxes from those toddlers at base camp with little tear-stained circles. Dear mummy, come home, we miss you. When are you coming home? This is enough. And that really devastated her, to be so far from these young children and just seeing their need for her on a piece of paper. And I can't help but think that those kinds of pulls toward home make it much more difficult to turn toward that deadly a place and put every focus of your energy on it.
We're speaking with Jennifer Jordan, the author of Savage Summit, The True Stories of the First Five Women Who Climbed K2. And, first of all, I'm just wondering, are you saying by that men go to escape where women climb for another reason?
That is an incredibly insightful question, Nathan. I've asked every climber, male and female, if high altitude climbing is a form of escapism. And the men all say, no, it's beautiful up there. And then they go into the reasons. Well, there's no clutter, and there's no relationships, and there's no, phone ringing. And I said, yeah, I mean, escaping from, as you say, the clutter of life. No, it's more. And the women that I've asked are very able to say, they list the passion, and they list how good they are at it, and they list how it fulfills a dream in them, and they list how you know, so few other women can do it, and so other people can do it. So they have very tangible A, B, C, D's of why they do it. And that was interesting to me, that the women have really seemed to have thought through what they're doing and how, you know, what a tiny minority they are in this community, and in a way that men haven't.
Well, to a much lesser degree, I was telling you that I've been rock climbing for a couple of years, and I absolutely do it to escape.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering about yourself personally.
Yes. I mean, I'm a trail runner. And when my knees didn't hurt or, you know, punish me so much, I was an ultra runner, and I would go out for hours at a time and compete in 50-mile races and Ironman triathlons. If you don't think that's escapism.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm very happy with, 45-minute hour run with the dog, and I stop and look at the beautiful mountains, and that's fine. It's interesting because a lot of people have asked, do you ever want to climb these mountains? And I say, no, listen, I've spent 7 years researching the dead women who have. So no, I do not want to climb these mountains, but I totally understand why they did, because I'm an arrogant athlete, and the athleticism of these mountains comes very easily to me. And when I, even at, to base camp at, 17 and 18,000 feet, I didn't feel the altitude. And, when I was living in Boston and my sister out here in Salt Lake, I could get on a plane at sea level, get off at 10 o'clock in the morning, and be up at Alta, 10,000 feet by noon, and not break a sweat. So I understand, if I'd grown up in a climbing community, say in Colorado or up in Washington State, I know I would have become a climber because I'm so strong. And I'm just so grateful that my arrogance led me into triathlon and led me into ultra running, where you can always stop if you're having a bad day. And you can always go home, and you aren't on that edge of death, which is an intoxicating place.
In mountaineering, there is so much more of it that goes beyond physical capacity. There is mental conditioning that you obviously have in other sports, but there are all of these environmental conditions that you have no control over.
Right.
And I think that goes back to what you said you discovered about these women and the reasons why they may have died on the mountain, and that was some unpreparedness, I think,
mm-hmm.
was your word.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think that was? Why weren't they as prepared?
Because I think that women tend to get coaxed, not quite the right word, into going to K2 before they should, because of the pressure of the media and sponsors and the climbing community. There are so few women, only six to date, who've made the summit of K2, and they represent only three nationalities. So guess what? All those other nationalities are looking at their female alpinists, high-altitude alpinists, and saying, hey, are you thinking about K2? Do you want to be the first American woman on K2? Do you want to be the first, name your nationality? First Russian, first South of, there's so many.
Well, also,
there's a lot of money out there to have a woman in your parka with your organization, with your logo on the top of this mountain, and that's one reason. And number two, the climbing community, I think, tries to, say, well, when are you going to go to K2? Sure, you've done Everest, but anybody can do Everest. Anybody with 65,000 and a strong rope can do Everest. K2 is really seen as the climber's mountain, and women like men are not shy of arrogance and not shy of thinking, sure, I can do it.
Well, absolutely. Also with fewer predecessors, it's not as easy to compare oneself to somebody else,
right,
and say, well, I'm in equal condition.
Right.
And I can do this.
Absolutely.
Nathan, you look like you have a question.
Well, yeah, this goes back a little bit, but with these women that you researched that made the climb, was there any common factor? Was there a background? Was there something in their childhood? Was it a marital status? Anything that would make them decide to take the trip? Or did a lot of it just have to do with what you just said, the peer pressure or being the first?
I think that these women of K2, like most of the other 5% of women alpinists, high altitude alpinists, share much of the same characteristics as men. I mean, I think that if you look at 5% of women across the population, you'll find that 5% are adventure athletes, 5% push the envelope, 5% become firefighters, 5% become cops, 5% become military. Hmm. So there's a percentage of women that seek this level of risk and danger. So that's one thing. I mean, it's really, at that point, it's not a gender issue. At that point, it becomes climber and mountain. And the fact that they're treated differently by men doesn't change the fact that a lot of their soul is very matched to the man who might be giving them trouble on the mountain. And that, you know, for me, the denominator, I mean, the common denominator between each of these women and the larger climbing community is passion. Mm-hmm. This is something that if they're not born to do, they become so obsessed by it that they can't do anything else. And I think there's also, getting back to the clutter of life, there's something about the purity of that experience in that thin air when you're absolutely alone, where a lot of people find their God and they find a level of their soul that they can't find down here in all the noise. And that becomes very hypnotic and something that they have to get back to. And that was shared, is shared, I believe, across the gender barrier between men and women high-altitude climbers, and certainly the women of Savage Summit.
Well, as you write in your book, though, for women, and also for men because they're there as well, they can't exactly leave clutter behind completely. They show up on the mountain to find another kind of mental clutter.
Right.
And that's each other.
Right.
Talk a bit about that.
Yes, and it is a clutter. It's interesting. I think the clutter and the noise diminish as they climb the mountain. You know, part of that's hypoxia, part of it's exhaustion, part of it's just as we said earlier, the body slowly dying. I mean, that's really what's happening. Once the body's in the death zone, it's in a race against death due to suffocation and lack of oxygen. So, as you go higher and out of base camp, the experience becomes more pure, I think, and you get into that solitude of the mind. But at base camp, it is a patent place, and there's a lot of gossip and down talking and backstabbing. And it really is. I mean, we had a great little team in 2002, and we all just love each other to death, and we're all very respectful. And in those days when things just got, you're either the personality type or the emotion or the hypoxia got too much, you just go to your tent and be alone, fine. But when you're dealing with all those other teams around you, with all that, when are they going up? Oh, what kind of rope do they have? Oh, look at that. Look at that ice axe. Ooh, I wonder who's sponsoring them. And, ooh, that ice axe is much better. That ice axe is a better climber than he is. I mean, it's just really, it's like grade school. And a lot of it's, interestingly enough, part of my research, I found that one of the hormones that is released in flood stage when the body hits altitude and starts to say, I can't breathe quite as well as I could, is estrogen. And men have estrogen in smaller amounts the same way that women have testosterone in smaller amounts. So guess what? Men have their first PMS of their lives at base camp. And it can get ugly.
I've had PMS, and I've never been at a base camp. I know what that's like, and no one believes me.
No, it's totally true. I mean, you see men like freaking, well, men and women, but men particularly, because women figure out, and once a month you feel a little weird, and you deal with it. But men don't really do well with the onrush of that emotion, and they don't know why they're crying over their potatoes, and they don't know why they're raging at the cook for cooking rice one too many nights in a row. And so a lot of them go toward rage rather than allow the softness of the emotion be, because they're embarrassed by the tears or they're embarrassed by their outrage. And it's really an interesting, I mean, that would be a fun book for me to write, I think.
Yeah. Does some of that dynamic play out? Is that targeted specifically toward women, perhaps?
I don't think so. I think it's just, base camp is an ugly place for everybody. And for women, it can get particularly ugly if they're not with a partner. Because, one woman in a barracks of scores of men, hello, it's It's not pretty down here at sea level, and it's really not pretty up there. You know, men don't like, sorry, Nathan, but men usually don't like forced celibacy. And it gets to be a little raucous. And, you know, some of them deal better with it than others, but there are times when it's just, you know, the women, you see the women, like, roll their eyes and say, oh, for God's sake, you know, really, boys.
Well, that happens everywhere, though, I think.
It does. And as I say, something
it's
about...
It's just exaggerated there.
Something about the high altitude makes it, you know, just exacerbated.
We're speaking with Jennifer Jordan, the author of Savage Summit. And before we go, Jennifer, before we were on air, we were speaking of the impact of global warming on the mountains. And I guess K2, all the Himalayas and everywhere have suffered.
Everywhere.
On account of this.
Polar bears are drowning in the Arctic, so you bet the Himalayas are being hit, especially because they're, you know, they're 20,000, 28,000 feet closer to the sun.
Does that make them a more unpredictable climb?
It makes it a more unpredictable climb because a lot of the traditional routes are cracking off. They're melting off and they come crashing down. Another thing, another factor is there's not as much snow coverage on a lot of these mountains, so that what has traditionally been a snow and ice climb has turned into a rock climb, and rock is a lot more dangerous on these mountains. So it's just changing literally the face of high altitude mountaineering.
Well, Jennifer Jordan, unfortunately we've run out of time. I want to thank you once again for being on our program. The book is Savage Summit, The True Stories of the First Five Women Who Climbed K2. Thanks very much.
Nathan, thank you. Enjoy. Nice speaking with you as well.